This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. We are ready to discuss the important events of this past week. Our panel is here. In the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
Via Skype from Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
The Netherlands had an election on Tuesday, and there was a strong push by the Freedom Party of Geert Wilders. This is a party with a platform of withdrawing the Netherlands from the European Union, leaving the euro, closing Dutch borders, stopping Islamic immigration. And polls before the election showed that this party could win. A lot of European establishment was deeply concerned about what would have been a massive victory for these populist forces in the heart of Europe. But the election went down, the results came in, and liberals everywhere breathed a sigh of relief. Dutch voters preserved the status quo. They reelected Prime Minister Mark Rutte's Liberal Party. The populist surge was defeated. The far right was rejected. The sky was not falling. That was certainly the sense you got from the headlines on Wednesday. But that wasn't the way the story read on thetrumpet.com. Richard Palmer wrote an article there titled, "Dutch Election, Political System Shatters." The subhead says, "Geert Wilders didn't lose. Instead, he's part of a dangerous trend sweeping Europe." Very provocative, Richard. Explain to us what you mean here.
Well, firstly, the victory for Mark Rutte, he lost 5 seats. He actually did pretty poorly compared to last time. And Geert Wilders came in second place. I think it's just remarkable. He increased his number of seats from 15 to 20. And I think it's just remarkable that him just coming second, you know, a party that's labeled as far right, that wants the Quran to be outlawed, compares it to Mein Kampf. You know, that was coming, them coming second and to so much in Europe, well, that Netherlands rejects far right, that's him defeated, that's a failure. You take that back just a couple of decades, and a party like that coming second would be headline news because of how well they're doing. Mm-hmm. So just the fact that them coming second is kind of branded as a defeat, and that in itself is a big shift within Europe.
Right. So this is kind of in the climate of Donald Trump victory and Brexit and these earth-shaking incidents that happened over this past year. And so the Netherlands giving this man a second place in this election, this is actually a victory in today's climate.
In some ways. But then you also look at how he got the victory or how Mark Rutte got that quote-unquote victory.
Yeah,
it was by channeling his inner Geert Wilders. Mm. And really, I mean, Geert Wilders, he set the agenda for this entire election. For James Traub, he wrote for Foreign Policy, in the weeks leading up to the vote, the Dutch have been preoccupied, almost obsessed by the issues of immigration, integration, and national identity. He said, everyone I spoke to in the boulevard agreed with some part of Wilders' nativist agenda. He has so thoroughly reshaped Dutch political culture that voters who share his views but find him ultra-vires or beyond the pale can vote for any number of parties that have taken a hard line on immigrants and Islam, including the VVD itself. So he has shifted the Netherlands' entire political system. And really, the reason why Mark Rutte did so well was largely due to Turkey. The weekend before the election, there was this massive spat with Turkey. And throughout it all, he took a really hard line. Initially, the Netherlands said, well, we're thinking about, they said, well, we're not going to provide protection for a Turkish rally, for a Turkish minister to come and give this rally because we're a bit concerned about security. The Turks then threatened the Netherlands and said, well, if you ban our rallies, we're going to do this and this and this and this and this. And so then Mark Rutte said, fine, we're banning your rallies. None of your Turkish ministers are allowed in the country. No, it was a very impressive standing up to Turkish threats. He didn't back down at all. It led to this kind of utterly farcical situation where the Turks were smuggling decoy ministers across the border from Germany into the Netherlands to try and distract the German police while they smuggled their actual minister. They had a couple of fake convoys, and then the final convoy came through with their actual minister that they smuggled across the border from Germany, and she was intercepted. There was kind of a standoff between her bodyguard and the Dutch police. A Turkish municipal authority ended up deporting a whole bunch of Dutch cows. There was a Dutch breed of cows. They stuck them on a boat and sent them back to the Netherlands. It kind of escalated, and Erdogan's going around calling the Dutch Nazis. But it was this kind of big blow-up that seemed like it drove a lot of people to Mark Rutte at the last minute. And so, you know, you can really see how that whole – he shifted the whole climate and the whole discussion within the Netherlands.
So how important is the Netherlands, say, for Europe more broadly? And we've been tracking this trend of the rise of far-right parties across Europe. Where does this fit in terms of victories for the far-right within Europe?
Right. It just confirms a pattern that we're seeing repeated again and again and again and again. Rise of the far right, but also rise of the fringe parties. And that was the other big takeaway from this election is now, instead of having one or two clear main parties, you've got, well, you've got Mark Rutte's party with, I think, around 33 seats. But then you've got about five parties with around 15 to 20 seats. So you've seen, you know, I think the figure was, if you go back to previous elections, typically the two largest parties have somewhere between around 65 to 80% of the vote. Now the two largest parties have 45% of the vote. So what you're seeing,
and one of them is Geert Wilders' party.
And one of them is Geert Wilders' party. That's right. And so it, you know, any coalition is going to have at least four parties in it. And they're going to have to include at least one party from the left, as well as parties from the right, if Geert Wilders is going to be excluded, which is what they've said. And so you're looking at the political system just shattering and the Netherlands becoming ungovernable, just, you know, with these coalitions that take months to form. It took Belgium over a year to get their coalition together recently. So you're seeing a dysfunctional political system. And you see that across Europe. You know, we see that, you saw that especially in German regional elections last year. And Germany's got their big election coming up in September. And again, you just see these votes getting split. And there they've got the Alternative for Deutschland. But then you've also got the Link, Die Linke, the left party in Germany that's very extreme on the left. You see this trend in Spain. You see it in Portugal. We've mentioned Belgium already. So it's the Netherlands. You know, if this was just the Netherlands that was coming up with this dysfunctional political system, it would be a big story for Dutch people. But this is about the whole political way of doing things in all of Europe stopping working. And that's going to have a major impact on the whole world if, you know, just the political system in Europe doesn't function properly anymore.
Well, Richard, I think you you did a good job of defending your case that the liberal view that you read in the headlines throughout most media wasn't quite the accurate reading of what happened there in the Netherlands. We appreciate that. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program. We have a couple of stories here about Russia. First, we're going to follow up on something we reported last month about Russia's engagement in Libya. And this week marked an escalation in what's happening there. And for this story, we're going to go to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, so on Monday, there was a pretty important exclusive report from Reuters that claimed that there was a small contingent of Russian soldiers that had made their way to an airbase in northern Egypt, right on the border with, of course, Libya. Well, just off the border with Libya. And this was, according to them, really the first time that Russian soldiers had made their way to North Africa for some time. They also said, this was based on both American and Egyptian intelligence and Egyptian sources. The Russians have denied that, and so have some of the Egyptian government officials denied that there's Russians in Egypt. But it's interesting because we just talked about this last month, how that inside Libya, across the border, Russia has been really trying to dictate the terms of the stabilization of that country. It supported one of the strong men based in the eastern part of Libya. And this past week, it looked like he might be supporting them with actual troops.
Right. Escalating what we were talking about last month, this we talked about how this puts a lot of pressure on the situation in terms of what Europe has been trying to build there in Libya. Maybe you can just help us to see the bigger picture here.
And I think this is the big point. And even Geopolitical Futures, they had a piece this week commenting on this report from Reuters. And they said that really Putin doesn't want to, he can't afford to have a huge military incursion into Libya. Controlling Libya with troops, what does that really buy him? Probably not too much. But he just wants to play that mediator role here in Libya to ensure that he can dictate peace terms going forward in that country, because that country is so valuable to Europe's stability, Europe's underbelly. We've talked on this program about the fact that it's in those ungoverned spaces that a lot of jihadists have grown in strength, be it Syria or Libya. And in those ungoverned spaces, it produces a territory where migrants can travel through, economic migrants, and also people fleeing violence in Africa can travel through up into Europe. And they've been doing that from Libya's coast to the tune of 170,000 just last year. Mm. So by increasing, or even if he hasn't actually done this, what's interesting about it is who's willing to test Putin on this. The very fact that there's a report that comes out that he's moved a handful of troops there, and you know, just looking at Syria and how much the reporting started inside Syria back 2 Octobers ago, saying that, oh, we might have spotted some Russian troops there, and the Russians came out and said, no, we've got no troops in Syria. And then there, lo and behold, a year later, he's dictated terms in Syria. Just the threat of Russian forces going into Libya to stabilize things or to work out things how they want. I mean, that'll get people thinking, especially in wondering in Europe whether they're going to have to deal with Putin in Libya.
Right. It does really seem to underline that analysis from a month back, just how Putin seems to be exercising every lever that he can in order to demonstrate his how much influence he has in Europe and how much he could inflict on Europe if he chose to do so.
Yeah, and that's what's interesting about what we said, and even Geopolitical Futures. He's just trying to build leverage on Europe. It's for some time in the future when he's going to come together with Europe for some type of deal. I give you this. I could make things difficult for you in Syria. I could make things difficult for you in Turkey. I could make things difficult for you in Ukraine or now in Libya. How about we come together and make some deal? Maybe we, stop the sanctions coming on Russian sanctions, something like that. He's just stacking the cards in his favor for a future deal with Europe.
And at very little cost, really. I mean, you're talking here about a small number of troops. It doesn't take much for him to kind of send a message and just keep Europe on its toes.
Yeah, and even if you look at what he did in Syria, that's exactly right as well. He's had really minimal engagement, probably a couple thousand troops, few planes, not that much money, and yet he's changed the face of the Middle East in a year's time, whether it be removing America's influence or becoming a greater threat to inflict pain on Europe.
Well, thanks for that, Brent. Meanwhile, President Vladimir Putin continues to make moves, making Eastern Europeans nervous. This week, he gave an order that will effectively absorb the armed forces of what used to be the nation of Georgia into the Russian military's command structure. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, this was on Tuesday. Mr. Putin instructed his government to finalize a deal that essentially absorbs the military forces of part of Georgia. It's the state of South Ossetia into Russia's military command hierarchy. And so the government there in Georgia is really alarmed by this. Europeans also are very concerned about it, because this shows that Putin is making serious progress in his drive to reconstruct that old Soviet empire. This story actually begins all the way back in 1992. That was just a year or so after the Soviet Union had collapsed and after Georgia had become an independent nation once again. And in 1992, the people in South Ossetia said that they didn't want to be part of Georgia anymore. They wanted to be their own tiny little country, free to be as closely aligned with Russia as they wanted to. Well, the Georgian government didn't like that, but they were too weak to really stop it. So for many years, South Ossetia existed as just sort of a semi-autonomous region in Georgia, and it was mostly at a state of peace with the rest of Georgia. But then in 2004, the Georgian government began to really apply a lot of pressure to bring South Ossetia back under Georgia's control. Clashes broke out, and serious tensions developed between Georgian forces and these South Ossetian separatists. And all this tension culminated in 2008, when Georgia carried out a pretty concerted ground and air assault on South Ossetia's main city. And at that time, Vladimir Putin couldn't really tolerate that attack. He sees South Ossetia as a very Russia-friendly state. It's right on the border of Russia there. So he couldn't tolerate this attack by Georgia. So he mobilized Russia's military and invaded Georgia. The Russian forces pushed Georgian soldiers out of South Ossetia, also out of Georgia's other Russia-friendly region, Abkhazia, and then maybe just as a show of force, they went way beyond those territories and pushed them way down into Georgia proper for quite a while. And after that war ended, Russia came out and officially recognized the independence of South Ossetia and of Abkhazia, and he asserted Russian control over those two regions. So it was really a naked land grab by Russia. That was 2008, and Georgia continues to this day to insist that both of those regions remain a part of Georgian territory, and international law supports that view too. Mm-hmm. But those kinds of claims by Georgia mean less and less as Russia continues to assert more control over South Ossetia. And so this new agreement on Tuesday to incorporate South Ossetia's armed forces into Russia's military really makes Moscow's control over this region certain in everything but name. Mm-hmm. So it means that where it counts, South Ossetia is part of Russia. You know, its military answers to Moscow, its government answers to the Kremlin. So in all but name, this sizable little region from this former Soviet nation is part of the new Russian Empire. So it's a pretty significant development there.
Yeah, we've talked quite a bit about just how canny Putin has been at his timing with a lot of these types of moves. And it seems like he tends to do this just as other nations are distracted by this or that problem. And he doesn't do too much at one time in order to raise too much ire from Russia's enemies. What sort of pushback has there been to this, or what kind of response?
Well, the Georgian government has decried it as an illegal and illegitimate deal, which is what we would have expected, really. And in Europe, there's a lot of concern about it. They see this, most Europeans, as a naked land grab. But there's not really been much that they can do about it. The Irish Times actually published a pretty interesting piece. We've linked to this on thetrumpet.com. But this Irish Times article explains that Europeans are fearful of Putin's reconstruction of the Soviet Empire, but right now they're too disunited to really do anything about it. The very last line of that Irish Times article says these are dangerous times. Mm-hmm. And you can really see how this Russian aggression could serve as a catalyst to really unite Europe.
Well, thanks for that, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 in America. One of Donald Trump's first actions as president was trying to block immigration from countries that are known incubators of Islamic terrorism. And there was quite a strong reaction, with some courts blocking this ban from the president. The Trump administration went back to the drawing board, tried a second version of the ban, trying to correct some of the problems with the first. And the courts weren't very excited about this one either. For this story, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
In a lot of ways, America's foreign policy right now is almost in gridlock, as courts have overstepped their constitutional bound and taking power that belongs to either the executive branch or the legislative branch. Like, so just kind of recapping what you'd mentioned previously, that was like, so this was one of the first actions of the Trump administration, is to temporarily ban immigration from seven nations known for exporting terrorists for a period of 120 days, which their 1965 Immigration Act, Congress has delegated that authority to the president to temporarily ban immigration in order to give the government time to look at if their vetting procedures are up to par. What the court had done is a judge in Washington State sued the president over the executive order, and a judge had ruled that the order was unconstitutional unless he could prove that there's a terrorist threat from Iran and Somalia and Iraq and Syria and these other nations on the ban, which, as a lot of constitutional originalists pointed out, that wasn't the judge's responsibility to determine if the threat was real. That was something Congress had delegated to the president. The judge is just supposed to rule whether or not the 1965 law said the president could temporarily ban immigration. So you'd have thought it would have probably almost been better if the Trump administration would have challenged this constitutional overreach as an act of constitutional overreach. But what they did instead is they just went back to the drawing board, rewrote the executive order. They dropped Iraq from the list and then took the six other nations and put in the proof that these are terrorist nations. These are nations that are exporting terrorists. Mm-hmm. So now what we've had happen this week is a judge in Hawaii looked at that order and pretty much admitted that the text of the order had nothing wrong with it. He did conclusively prove that the six nations he banned had a significant terrorist threat. But he said, based on comments Trump and other people in the Trump administration had made in the past, he basically felt that there was like a spirit of animosity toward Muslims that was driving the president's decision. So he's basically now, he's not playing the role of a judge. He's playing the role of like a psychotherapist, trying to figure out, it's like, okay, well, there's nothing wrong with the text, but it's like, why is the president doing this? And it looks like he's doing this because he's trying to create a Muslim ban through loophole. So I will strike it down on that regard.
Yeah, it's phenomenal, naked overreach on the part of these judges that are completely exceeding the bounds of what the law gives them the right to do. What's been the response to this ban this time?
Obviously, President Trump has condemned it as an act of judicial overreach. I mean, they're going to appeal it to the Ninth Circuit Court, which no one's
which
really
not great fans of the Trump administration on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
And then they may end up appealing both Ninth Circuit Court rulings to the Supreme Court, which takes time. And so if you get a constitutional originalist like Neil Gorsuch on there, it'll be interesting to see if maybe they can strike down some of these rulings later in the year, although in the past month, they've already had, I think, 4,000 refugees from those seven banned countries make it into the nation. So if the president's right that there's a terrorist threat from some of these refugees, that's not a good sign that their vetting procedures are broken. And apparently he now needs consensus from all 1,750 federal judges to make any sort of decision on enforcing the nation's immigration laws.
Well, yeah, you said at the beginning that this represents gridlock on the part of the Trump administration's ability to conduct its foreign policy. That really says it, doesn't it? If everything has to be go through all of these appeals and all of the courts have to agree on this before it can be enforced, we've got a real problem.
Right, and that's why Congress made the law in 1965 in the first place, is obviously the Constitution gives Congress the power to make these decisions, but Congress realized that sometimes there's an emergency situation where it takes them too long to make a decision. So they said, well, okay, well, the president can temporarily ban immigration while we figure out what to do. But now the courts have kind of stepped in and taken that power away from both Congress and the president, to that you need consensus between, you've got an even bigger problem than needing a congressional consensus, and you need consensus amongst every federal judge, apparently, to.
Not a good way to conduct your business as a nation. We appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about a push for another referendum on independence for Scotland, a bold move by Japan to counter China's activity in the South China Sea, a pornography scandal in the U.S. Marines, and why Israelis were awakened this morning with the sounds of warning sirens and explosions. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This week, if you visited thetrumpet.com, you may have seen a new video feature called Trumpet Talk. This first one that we posted there, it's a five-minute conversation between Trumpet contributors Brad McDonald and Richard Palmer. Very slick video. They recorded it in our television studio in Edstone. They were discussing the fact that Scotland just announced, just 2 years after a failed referendum on breaking away from the United Kingdom, they're going to have another one. To catch us up to speed on this story, we're going to go back to Britain and hear from Richard himself.
That's right. This week, the Scottish First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, announced that next week she's going to begin the process for calling for a new referendum. At the time when they held the last referendum, she said this would settle the issue for a generation. Apparently, that's over already. We need to vote again. The excuse this time is the Brexit vote. Britain voted to leave the European Union, while only about 40% of Scots voted to leave the European Union. And so apparently that means that they need to have a new referendum. If you're a little more cynical, you see her opinion ratings falling. You see the Scottish National Party at the moment. There's a majority in favor of independence in the Scottish Parliament between the National Party and the Greens. After next election, that probably won't be the case. So this is kind of their last big chance to call for a referendum, and they wanted an excuse to call one, and now it looks like they found it.
So this is not going to take place immediately. This is setting the wheels in motion for something that would take place over, 2019.
Well, actually, this is where it gets interesting. It looked like 2019 was when Nicola Sturgeon wanted it. The process for calling for a referendum, the Scottish Parliament first has to vote for it, and then the British Parliament at Westminster has to approve it. Now, the Prime Minister, Theresa May, have said she does not want to allow one in 2019. And initially, it seemed like that she was going to approve one for 2021. However, in the past couple of days, it looks like she might have come up with a clever strategy to stop the referendum happening at all. We'll still have to see, but it looks like what she's going to do is say, we'll give you a referendum. However, you have to prove to us that there is a democratic mandate for a new referendum, seeing as you just had one. To do that, you need to run in the next Scottish Parliament elections with a manifesto pledge to hold a referendum. If you gain a majority in that next parliamentary election, then we will agree to hold a referendum. Now, the next Scottish parliamentary elections are probably not until 2021. It is unlikely that the Scottish National Party will be able to gain a majority for that. So if successful, this tactic may actually kill the second referendum. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. But so there's still going to be a big tussle over timing. And now it looks like there could be a tussle over whether it actually does happen at all.
Well, put this in context for us in terms of Britain, and they're obviously in the middle of trying to extricate themselves from Europe. This adds an additional layer of complexity to British politics and uncertainty about Britain's future. Help us to see how this complicates things.
Right. So firstly, the previous referendum, it was hugely divisive. And having the existence of your country hang in the balance is not at all pleasant. And then there was just a lot of there was a huge amount of anti-English rhetoric coming from a relatively small number, but coming from some very passionate Scottish nationalists. And it's kind of disconcerting to know that your fellow countrymen hate you so much, or at least some do. Then, of course, that called forth a lot of anti-Scottish rhetoric from Britain. So it caused a lot of division in the Union within Scotland. One in four Scots said that it caused a permanent damage to a relationship with a friend or family member. There were a lot of pretty intense arguments, as I think you could well imagine, if, say, like Texas or California were voting to secede. So that division is not at all good for the nation. And then, yes, you're right. Britain goes into the referendum, I mean, into the independence negotiations with the European Union. Okay, so now we've got to work on our trade relationship with Europe. We've got to go to just about every other nation in the world and try and work out a trade deal with them, because previously all of our trade deals have been done through the European Union. And so it's going to be a hugely involved process, a hugely complicated process as it is. The Scottish referendum, well, it gives something else, the British government, something else to worry about. They've got to be worrying about, okay, well, what's our relationship with Scotland? Is the Union going to even exist anymore? And then it gives the European Union kind of a backdoor in negotiations, a way that they could hurt Britain. If Britain kind of tries to play too hardball, they could threaten to really excavate the problems with Scotland and to maybe bring Scotland into the European Union as Britain leaves. That would be hard for the European Union to do, but it remains there as an option. It just greatly complicates the task facing Britain. And it almost guarantees that Britain is now going to spend the next 5 years or so focused very inwards, instead of pursuing a global agenda, just trying to sort its place in the European Union out and then sort its very existence out again, even though we just went through this whole process a few years ago.
These are headaches that those who were so excited about Brexit were probably not anticipating or hoping could be avoided, actually, especially considering the fact that they had just made this decision 2 years ago. But it kind of gives you a sense of what life after Brexit in Britain is like. It's not so sunshiny.
That's right. I mean, we all love our countries, and it is easy to kind of get caught up in that rhetoric of the vision that they were talking about for Britain out of the European Union. It was such a wonderful, such a beautiful picture. You know, we're going to make Britain great again. Britain's going to be a world power again. We're going to make a difference. We'll be, you know, life will be so much better within Britain, and we'll be able to make a big difference on the world. And this is where it kind of hits reality, that, you know, all those divisions that were there within Britain, all those problems that led to the first Scottish referendum, that led to the Scots even, you know, being in the lead at some points and it being quite a narrow result, those problems are still there. Much as we might like to think that we're heading now into these, you know, a second golden age for Britain, it's not. You know, there's still huge problems there. The European Union hasn't, you know, leaving Europe hasn't gotten rid of those huge problems. And Britain still needs to make some massive changes if it wants to be a great nation again.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate that, Richard. We're going to turn now back to Asia. We focused a lot of attention in recent years on China's belligerence in the South China Sea. Well, this week, Japan gave a bit of an indication of what it thinks of China's activities in a move that suggests it actually might want to establish its own military presence in the South China Sea. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, Japan said on Tuesday that the Maritime Self-Defense Force will dispatch its largest warship on a three-month tour through the South China Sea. And this was really big news for Japan watchers because it represents Japan's largest show of military force since World War II. The South China Sea, of course, is claimed almost in its entirety by China. And in the last few years, we've seen China getting really belligerent in asserting its authority and control over this vast part of the ocean there. And a lot of the weaker nations whose territory that China is claiming have essentially learned to just back off and let China do what it wants to. But Japan, which doesn't actually even have any claims in the South China Sea, is now suddenly standing up to China in quite a bold way. This three-month tour will begin in May, and the Japanese warship will stop in Singapore, Indonesia, the Philippines, and Sri Lanka before it finally arrives in the Indian Ocean to participate in some joint naval drills with the U.S. and India. So it's a really bold show of force, and a big part of the reason why it's considered to be the biggest show of military force since the end of World War II for Japan is because of the specifics of the warship that's being dispatched. This ship is the largest one Japan has. It's the Izumo-class helicopter carrier, a huge and extremely advanced piece of military machinery. And this warship can carry up to 400 Marines and up to 14 attack helicopters, according to some analysts. And it's interesting because Japan is not allowed to have any offensive weapons. Japan has a pacifist constitution, which forbids that. So they officially label the Izumo helicopter carrier as a destroyer. Destroyer is a class of vessel with largely defensive weapon systems that are not really able to project power in an offensive manner. But if you look at the specs of the Izumo, you see that this destroyer label is it's just not really accurate at all. This ship is equipped with the latest in electronic warfare, fire control, and radar systems. It has phalanx and CRAM, close-in weapon systems, and a lot of other incredibly impressive weaponry. And I'll just read a quick quote here from the Center for International Maritime Security about the Izumo. It says, "Given this potential, simply calling these ships helicopter destroyers could be construed as misleading or even deceptive. Therefore, we can surmise that the classification is largely for political purposes, designed to let Japan circumvent the ban on it acquiring offensive weaponry. This warship serves as a warning to China and North Korea that Japan is indeed a maritime power to be reckoned with." Mm-hmm. So just the very existence of the Izumo helicopter carrier runs counter to Japan's pacifist constitution, because it is a vessel able to project power in an offensive manner. And now Japan is deploying this for a three-month tour in the South China Sea, where it doesn't even have any claims of territory. So it's a pretty significant development. It marks a major step in Tokyo's march toward remilitarization. And I think that we can expect this to intensify the tensions in the region, especially China's aggression there.
Yeah, you kind of look at two trends here. One is just Japan's militarization generally. This is a trend that we've followed for quite some time, and just how it continues to take steps away from adherence to that Article 9 and its constitution. And also this tension between Japan and China is really interesting to keep our eye on. As you kind of alluded to there, how does China respond? It's basically been able to do its business and what it wants in the South China Sea without any real pushback from anyone. This is a fairly provocative move on Japan's part. To this point, the tension between those two seems like it's been restricted mostly to words. But here you're talking about hard military hardware that's being used in a way that really could escalate things.
Yes, I think it really could. I think a part of the reason for this is that President Obama didn't really stand up to China. He did a few freedom of navigation exercises and things like that. But with the new administration there, with President Trump, I believe Japan feels a little emboldened. Mm-hmm. The Japan-U.S. alliance is becoming stronger under Trump right now. So I think it's emboldened Japan. And yeah, I'm not sure what China will do, but I'm sure that they're not happy to suddenly have someone standing up to them.
Well, keep us updated. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. Over the years, Iran has repeatedly made clear its desire to destroy the Jewish state of Israel. And an announcement this week from an Iranian-backed Shiite militia revealed one way that Iran is continuing to press forward with this objective. And for this story, we're going to go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
We've heard lots about how much Iran has been moving inside Syria to support its ally there through various militias that they've sent into the country, Shiite militias that do answer to Iran. Well, one of those is translated the Movement of the Noble, and it has about 10,000 fighters inside Syria. It was very effective in helping Iran with the siege in Aleppo just late last year. Well, now that group has decided to form another brigade, and it's called the Golan Liberation Brigade. And it's talking about how that right now we have still some anti-Assad rebels occupying the territory on Israel's border, northeastern border, the Golan Heights. And the first goal of this group is to get rid of those anti-Assad forces. And then should the Assad ask for it, they say that they're ready to participate in a liberation of the Golan Heights from Israel. So this is interesting because what we've seen in the Syrian civil war is Iran get more involved there, and coming towards the end of this war, it looks like you're going to have another Iranian proxy with 10,000 men right on the northeastern border of the Israeli state.
What does this say about, Iran's ultimate purpose in its activities in Syria? We've talked about the fact that at some point we expect a divide between Syria and Iran. And yet what you're looking at here seems like this is Iran aiming at maybe a larger objective and being able to accomplish that larger objective, even whether or not it has that relationship with the political leadership in Syria.
Yeah, this is a militia that answers directly to Tehran, not anything to do with Assad. So they may be preparing themselves for the potential of maybe not having such an ally in Assad. Nevertheless, they're setting up one of their proxies on Israel's border, similar in a way that they do with Hezbollah inside right. Lebanon. Right. Not all of Lebanon. There's plenty of people in Lebanon that hate Iran, that don't want to be Iran's proxy, but you have Hezbollah so powerful in southern Lebanon because of the fight against Israel that they're able to maintain to be a constant threat against the Israeli state. And that's what Iran wants. They want to be able to not just be in power in Lebanon, but be able to threaten Israel from the north. And they've done that through a number of wars against Israel from the north. And now they virtually are going to try and encompass the north and then the northeast all the way down to Israel's border with Jordan with their own proxies that answer directly to them, regardless of the state controller and their relationship with Iran.
I'm just reminded as you're talking about the interview that you and I did a few weeks back where you were looking at some of the rhetoric coming from the Ayatollah Khomeini against Israel. And it is the type of language that can fall out of the headlines just because it from time to time he'll say these things about just how the Jews need to be eliminated and so on. But what you see here is teeth being put behind that rhetoric. You see actual men on the ground. You see putting money where his mouth is, don't you?
Right, exactly. Iran, they've always had their ultimate goal of Jerusalem. They recognize the need that, how much Jerusalem would be able to motivate the Arab world, according to Iran's what Iran wants, get the Arab world on side. And so this is a way of doing that. Any Arab group that attacks Israel does receive applause throughout the Arab world, whether you're with Iran or not. And there's no chance that this 10,000 strong militia would be able to threaten the viability of the state of Israel as according to being take over the Israeli military. That's not going to happen. But when you just add these factors together with so many, as we're going to talk about, even the lightning round, how many rockets are now pointing at Israel from northern Israel, from Hezbollah. Then you've got the Sinai Peninsula that's got jihadis all around it. Now you've got the Golan Heights. It's further surrounded with jihadis that want Israel gone. You can see that Iran can do a lot of damage mm-hmm. against Israel. And they're happy with the long game. The war of attrition is what they've been after for a long time. And these are just more signs that that Iran still has that as a number one goal, regardless of what they're doing elsewhere in the Middle East.
Brent, before I let you go, you're there in Jerusalem. I just wondered if you happened to hear any strange noises this morning about 3 a.m.
Yeah, I didn't hear the noises, but they definitely were heard in the Jordan Valley. There was a couple of surface-to-air missiles that were launched from Syria by Assad against Israeli jets that were just returning home from a raid in Palmyra, in central Syria. Apparently, they were attacking an arms convoy that was meant to be going to Hezbollah. They didn't want that to happen. As they were going back, these surface-to-air missiles were fired against Israeli jets. Syria claims they downed an Israeli jet. Israel says, no, you didn't. And what we saw was their arrow defense system, defense shield, that Israel's arrow defense shield that normally is meant to be used to stop ballistic missiles, intercontinental ballistic missiles from hitting Israeli's territory. But that was fired and actually destroyed one of these surface-to-air missiles over the Jordan Valley. So, no, I didn't hear it. But there were plenty of people in Israel that heard the sirens to take cover.
How important is this? It seems like quite a significant escalation, certainly between Israel and Syria. Yet Israel says nobody was ever in any danger. Is this the type of thing that just kind of blows over?
Not really. This is a probably in the past 6 years of the Syrian civil war, this is the strongest back and forth between Syria and Israel that we've seen. And I think it could indicate some type of push, even by the Iranians, as they try and support Assad, to try and if they consider themselves in a dangerous position, attacking Israel is always a good way to gain favor back in your own country and also through the Arab world. And we might see more of these attacks if Assad feels like he's being backed into a corner.
Interesting stuff. We appreciate that, Brent. And you're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program. This is 101.3 KPCG. United States Marine Corps calls honor the bedrock of Marines' character. The Marines' official website says this is the quality that empowers Marines to exemplify the ultimate in ethical and moral behavior. It represents the maturity, dedication, trust, and dependability that commit Marines to act responsibly. News came out last week that showed quite a few Marines demonstrating the opposite of ethical and moral behavior and maturity and responsibility. For this story, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
This story was broke on March 4th by investigative journalist and Purple Heart recipient Thomas Brennan, who had revealed some of his sources had told him the existence of this Facebook group that was sharing these photographs of female Marines that they had either been taken without their knowledge or that they had taken of themselves and shared with somebody privately and was later leaked publicly. And so this has been something that there's been a widespread condemnation from Congress and from like senior leadership of the Marine Corps. There's still latest headline. It looks like there may be over 1,000 people involved in this. And it looks like it's even as they're investigating more that this is spreading into even other branches of the service like the Air Force and the Army and the Navy. And they've already Defense Secretary has ordered like new guidelines, just kind of talking about like social media ethics for the Marines to try to stop this. But the big story that you definitely won't be hearing from a lot of other media outlets, and even a lot of other media outlets would disagree with, is this is really symptomatic of a problem that's been spread throughout America and America's armed services for many years, which is just endemic pornography usage. And then a lot of people will kind of get upset when you start linking like quote unquote casual pornography usage with something like a non-consensual pornography ring like this one. Though, I mean, there is study after study after study after study that shows that once you get into like this addicted to pornography, there is both a physical and a psychological rewiring of the brain that makes sex crimes more likely. And that's something that, I mean, it's thought that probably up to 10% of American citizens are, quote, like regular users of pornography.
What does that mean, I wonder?
Regular, and I think that's probably like once a month is the definition I'd read for that.
Well, there was this in the article. You have this article up on the Trumpet site, Pornography Scandal Rocks U.S. Military, and you quote this chaplain who said he felt like 20% of the military being addicted to pornography. This was back in 2013. He said that, that'd be a conservative estimate. But it seems like with pornography being as mainstream as it is, that those numbers really seem low. Like you would expect, just the climate being what it is today, that it would be even higher numbers than that. It makes me wonder just how they define addiction or regular usage.
And it is a hard number to get a grasp on, because different people define addiction different ways, and even some people who are addicted may be loath to admit it to the researchers who do these studies. So when they're talking about 10% of society in general, I'm thinking that's probably 10% who are not just that they use it occasionally, but they're using it a lot. And then a lot of military chaplains will tell you that they think that number's higher in the military, and it might not be so much to do in particular with military culture, just so much it is to do that in society in general, it's probably a vice more prevalent amongst young males, which if you have the military as young male, that this is, they're drawing their recruits from society. Mm-hmm. And so you're getting the same levels of addiction that are coming right out of American society, and that leads into scandals like this one. And so now you've got, in some of these congressional hearings, you have people like, I think Senator Elizabeth Warren, we're talking about like, well, maybe if we have the men and the women train in boot camp together, they'll respect each other more and things like this won't happen, which is a fairly, I mean, there's a whole other topic I could get into on women in the military in the first place, but this is a fairly naive assessment as they're talking about, and a lot of these people in Congress and in society, I mean, they glorify in Americans' right to view pornography and then really condemn a scandal like this where it's get some non-consensual pornography, but in a lot of ways that is like chucking rocks into a pond and then scrambling to contain the ripples within such and such a diameter. Like I said, you're never going to stop the ripples from happening once you've thrown the rock.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to cut it off there. Definitely a lot more that you could talk about there on that subject. And Mr. Stephen Fleury talked about that in the Trumpet Daily Radio Show this morning, discussing some of those ramifications. You can go and listen to that. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Visit us online at thetrumpet.com, and you can read the stories that we talk about on the program here that we have up on that front page of our website. We'll finish the program with our lightning round of important news. That's coming up next.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
It's time now for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some headlines from this past week that caught our attention, and we'll start with Jeremiah.
China announced on Monday that it will increase the size of its Marine Corps from about 20,000 to 100,000 personnel. That's about a 400% increase. And the purpose is to protect China's maritime lifelines and its growing interests overseas. This massive increase will let China deploy more soldiers in Djibouti there in the Horn of Africa, and also in Gwadar in southern Pakistan. So it shows that China is really getting serious about trying to posture itself as a global power.
All right, we'll go now to Brent.
This week, President Trump's senior advisor on international negotiations, Jason Greenblatt, was in Israel meeting almost everybody he could in order to get the ball rolling with Trump's peace plan. He had two long meetings with Mr. Netanyahu, during which he attempted to negotiate a settlement freeze, which at this point doesn't look like it went through. He also met in Ramallah with Palestinian Authority leader Mahmoud Abbas. And this follows a call between Mr. Trump and Abbas on March 10th, where he invited him to come to the White House. Now, what's interesting about these meetings is that from Trump's pre-election rhetoric, it seemed that he was extremely pro-Israel. Now, with these overtures towards the Palestinians, it looks like he really is going to push hard for a peace deal. And given the fact that Israelis don't have too much to give without putting their security in jeopardy, we may see the relationship between the Trump administration and Israel quickly deteriorate.
And let's go to Andrew.
Teachers at a primary school in Sydney, Australia, are being threatened with beheading and other violence by Islamic students as young as 10 years old. In one particular instance, the teacher had asked some students to take down a Syrian flag they'd hung up and was threatened by some of these young students that they were going to cut her head off if she didn't stop disrespecting their culture. Documents given to the Telegraph reveal that up to 3 teachers have already resigned due to the stress of the job. Though to date, there's really been nothing done except for one statement by the principal that eventually he will get these students to respect Australian values of tolerance and respect.
Mm. Back to Jeremiah.
U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson spent most of this week visiting Northeast Asia, and the tour comes as tensions are running really high in the region, mostly due to North Korea's increasingly erratic and belligerent actions there. And today, Mr. Tillerson said that it's too late for more talk with North Korea. Talk has done nothing to stop their nuclear program, and he said America may need to start to seriously consider a preemptive strike. So that's a frightening possibility because it could escalate into a full-blown regional confrontation.
All right, let's hear from Richard.
German soldiers prepared to assist in domestic security for the first time since the end of World War II recently. 360 Bundeswehr soldiers were incorporated into joint terrorism defense exercises in 6 German states. This represents quite a dramatic watering down of the German constitution and a further relaxation of the restrictions that were placed on the German military at the end of World War II.
All right, we'll go back to Brent.
Iran has established rocket facilities in Lebanon that are under the control of Hezbollah. The Kuwaiti newspaper Al Jarida reported on Monday, and that report was citing a deputy head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. These factories are said to be located under the ground and have reportedly been in operation for the past 3 months. Their staff includes advisors from the IRGC, as well as hundreds of Lebanese experts trained at the Imam Hussein University in Tehran. The Iranian general said that the decision to produce rockets in Lebanon directly came after Israel bombed weapon facilities in Sudan, as well as the supply routes from Iran via Syria.
Now let's go to Jeremiah.
The first pieces of America's Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD, anti-missile system have arrived on South Korean soil. We talked about this a little last week. And as a result of this system being set up, China is now calling for Russia and Beijing to work together more closely than ever. The Global Times this week said, quote, "Under these circumstances, China and Russia should enhance strategic coordination and deepen cooperation. If China and Russia can cooperate to counter the U.S. anti-missile system, it will benefit regional strategic stability and deal a heavy blow to the U.S.
All right, we'll finish with Andrew.
United States President Donald Trump unveiled his budget proposal for 2018 this Thursday. In particular, this proposal would increase defense spending by $54 million while cutting other agencies to offset the cost. The Environmental Protection Agency would be stripped of about 30% of its funding, while other agencies like agriculture, labor, and the State Department would have experienced 20% funding cuts. Overall, this new proposal would cut discretionary budget spending by about 1.2%.
Seemed like it would be more than that. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Visit thetrumpet.com. And you can tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Pleasure to be here.
Great to be here.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Sidney Harris. The two words information and communication are often used interchangeably, but they signify quite different things. Information is giving out. Communication is getting through. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.
and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.